Hello, everybody. My name is Scott Stranger. I am a recovered alcoholic. Everybody here okay? Can everybody here okay? I say I'm a recovered alcoholic, and I know that is the nomenclature here at Burnsville, and everybody's used to hearing that, but I'm also aware of the fact that there are some new people in the room tonight that might not really understand what that means, so I thought I would explain it a little bit. To me, being a recovered alcoholic simply means that a day at a time, I don't suffer from the obsession to drink and use anymore. It's that simple. That second step, alcoholic insanity, has been lifted from me. It's the furthest thing from my mind, and it's been that way for quite some time. And I don't say it like it's a permanent thing. You know, our literature points out that we get a daily reprieve based on our spiritual condition. The way I understand that is, if I get a broken arm, I can recover from it. Doesn't mean I can't break my arm again. And I've broken my arm several times in the last 30 years, so I have some experience with that. What I'd like to just also say before I start is that, you know, we're supposed to come up here and share our experience, strength, and hope. And what that translates to me is, and again, this is just my experience. I like to think I don't have very many opinions on our program recovery anymore. I'm going to try to just talk about my experience. And my experience is that I'm here really to testify and to give witness to the power of the God of my understanding and the miracles that He's performed in my life, and nothing short of that. I don't know how else to explain it. Because there is no logical reason for me to be standing up in front of you tonight sober, relatively sane, or at all. It just doesn't add up when you think about it. That kind of stuff only happens in the fourth dimension. It doesn't happen to people like me. I grew up in Bayonne, New Jersey. I'm going to try not... What's the latest ruling on profanity here? No? Yes? No? Well, my point is, you know, you can take the boy out of Bayonne, but I'm not so sure you can take Bayonne out of the boy. So if I go off track a little bit, just pardon me. It's not intentional. Some of my earliest memories growing up, I believe I was born an alcoholic. I wasn't sure what that meant, but I can tell you what it felt like. I was a kid at the birthday party in third grade that was standing out in the backyard looking up at the sky waiting for the mothership to come and get me because I felt so different from and apart from. I truly felt alone amongst all my peers, always. There was always something very different. Having gone through the work, the program recovery is laid out in our book, in our basic text, I've come to understand that as being a spiritual malady. Sometimes I think of it as a spiritual calling. And it was very painful for me as a child. No matter what was going on, or at least this is what my alcoholic mind reported to me, I can't tell you that this is absolutely true. I can just tell you what it felt like and how it was experientially for me. You know, whether I was the most popular kid on the block, or a part of the gang, or, you know, a good athlete, or whatever it was, no matter how many accolades I had, no matter how many people taught me or said to me that I was bright, you know, that, you know, I was good looking, whatever the case may be, I always felt separate and apart from that. I don't want to say I felt like a faker. I want to felt like that stuff just didn't matter because I felt so distant, always. You know, and I've come to realize after going through the work, that's what we're referring to when we talk about our spiritual illness. It manifests as being restless, irritable, and discontent. And I can tell you, that's what I experienced growing up always. Nothing was ever good enough. I couldn't be present in the moment. You've heard these descriptions a million times. And what I used to distract myself was bright, shiny objects. You know, when I was a kid, it was toys. You know, as I got older, it was women and motorcycles and fast cars, anything, money, anything, anything to draw my attention away from that spiritual malady, you know, for lack of any original terminology. I don't know what else to call it. you know. Everybody in here knows what I'm talking about. You know, I grew up kind of, I would say, lower middle class. What I do remember is that my dad's paycheck in the late 60s was $150 a week from one job, and he worked two others. My father didn't start making a living until he was in his mid-40s. And what I also, and again, there was a lot of good times, I guess, growing up in my house, but for some reason, they don't jump out. They don't jump out. What I remember about growing up is that there was a lot of screaming and yelling in my house. There wasn't a lot of talking. I have a sister that's 8 years older than I am, and I believe she was also born with this illness, although she never had issues with substances like alcohol and or other, you know, other drugs. She became a brainiac. She skipped two grades, graduated valedictorian of a private high school, you know, was editor of the Law Review in law school. She went that way. Later up in life, it caught up with her. Her spiritual malady caught up with her in different ways, and she's been disabled for the last 25 years, pretty much bedridden. But what I remember from my childhood is my father waking me up at 2 o'clock in the morning to drive down to Philly to pick my sister up to drive to a psych ward because she either flipped out on acid or just had some kind of crazy nervous breakdown. And the times that she was in my house, you know, my mother and father had a relationship, God bless them. They never talked, they screamed at each other. And I've come to understand that that's how they related. It's none of my business, and they loved each other. But there was a lot of screaming in my house. When my sister was around, there was a lot of stuff flying through the air. And what I learned at a very early age was to run. I used to run down to the basement steps, put my hands over my ears and start singing as loudly as I could just to get to a place where it was relatively quiet. I was a setup. I was a setup. You know, alcohol and that other stuff was just waiting for me. You know, I just want to share very quickly, I'm going to qualify. I do remember my first drunk like it was yesterday. And, there was this kid on my street. See, I grew up in the Bay Area streets, not roads. You know, just got to go down the block. He and I went to my dad's liquor cabinet. And, I don't know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. Remember those wine sacks we used to take to dead shows? You know what I'm talking about? All right. We filled 30 things up into one of those wine pouches. And we went into this alleyway on Avenue C. And it's crystal clear. Here's what happened. We downed that thing in about 5 minutes. My friend Billy, who's not an alcoholic, had the normal alcoholic reaction. He got the spins, he puked his guts out. Well, he laughed for a couple minutes, then he got the spins, puked his guts out, all right, passed out. I, however, found a home. I got 10 feet tall, it got very quiet in my head. All of a sudden, I thought I was charming, I thought I was handsome, I thought I could basically rule the world. And I got this message in my head that said, oh, this is what life is supposed to feel like. This is what's been missing. This is the part that fixes me so I can feel like everybody else. Because I thought that's what everybody else in my life walked around feeling like all the time. And that message pretty much ruled the rest of my life. It wasn't very long before, maybe a few years, before I was overdosing on a regular basis. You know, we all talk about that ability that we have to drink anybody under the table. And I had that gift. And I don't know of a drug that I didn't use. I don't know of a brand of alcohol that I didn't use to oblivion. And I literally overdosed 8 times and was brought in cyanotic without a pulse 3 of those times. And that's one of the reasons why I feel like I'm more like this person. There's no reason for me to be here. The long and the short of it is I started doing my tour of rehabilitation centers and therapeutic communities somewhere in 1978. I remember my first AA meeting in 78. I was 18 years old. To give you some perspective, I'm going to be 50 in January. And in 78, what AA looked like to me, literally, it was a carrier clinic and there was a bunch of old guys out on the porch. And there was no way. I was nowhere near ready. I still had too many miles left to go. A few stages to Fair Oaks, Karen Foundation. There was a therapeutic community called Integrity House back in the day, which was a whole lot of fun. Something they used to call old treatment. I said something to my roommate one day, and for the next week, I was wearing a diaper and a sign that said, "I'm a baby, ask me why." And then I remember having to beg for the privilege of having the other half of my head shaved, because they would shave half your head and see how that worked out for you. Then another time they turned me into a wall, which meant I basically faced a wall for 2 weeks, standing, doing nothing. Try that. Try it for 5 minutes. Did meditation stuff. So those are the fun things that I experienced as a young man. Finally, when I was about 26 years old, 1986, I had hit some kind of a new low, and I think for the first time I had a moment of clarity. I did a conversation with my sister, who happened to be in the same graduate school I was attending. And she said, "You know, Scott, maybe it's not mom and dad, maybe it's not me, maybe it's not your girlfriends, maybe it's not money, maybe you have a drug or alcohol problem. Did you ever consider that?" And, you know, I had ample evidence. I was living in Los Angeles for 2 years. I had 7 DUIs. And I said, "Okay, I think I'm hearing this." And I checked into yet another rehab, Cedars-Sinai, out there back in the day. And I went after it. I truly, for the first time in my life, started chasing recovery. And got a sponsor. And I think a lot of you guys have had the same experience I had, at least you older folks. Back in those days, in the mid-80s, 90s even, probably in the 70s, wasn't a whole lot of Big Book going on. At least that wasn't my experience. So I did this four-step with this guy that was sponsoring me. And, you know, never was I shown the book. He just said to me, "Scott, write down all the stuff that keeps you up at night." And just to show you how powerful this program is, even the fellowship, because I don't knock the fellowship. I don't think you can stay sober alone on the fellowship, but I don't knock the fellowship. Fellowship alone, I stayed absolutely stone sober for 8 years, just from doing that little piece of four-step work and trying to carry that little piece of the message that I had to other alcoholics. All right? It was a very powerful jolt for me. We didn't talk back then about what 12-step work was really about. Again, there was no Big Book flying around. It's amazing to me how you can buy a Big Book in just about any AA meeting, but God forbid you try to bring it back into that meeting. It's not that well received. Yet I digress. What happened was I ended up sponsoring Campus Summit, New Jersey, when I moved back from L.A., which was easy to do because nobody knew any better. And I was going to a lot of speaking commitments. I was starting a lot of meetings, sponsoring a lot of guys. The only problem was I was carrying my message, not the message, because I didn't know what the message was. I had no exposure to our basic text or the program recovery. What I do remember is about 8 years in, sitting in a meeting, in a summit meeting, and saying to the guy next to me, because at this point I was already, all that was left for me to do is pick up the drink, I was gone. I said to this guy, "If I hear one more fucking newcomer whining about his day, I'm going to bitch slap him." That's the kind of recovery I had. Needless to say, it wasn't much long after that that I picked up after 8 years. And I have to tell you, if you want to talk about the progression of the illness, the next 16 months were 300 times worse than any addiction I ever had, than any DTs I ever had. I could not stop. All of my I nevers came true. I was going to 3 meetings a day for 16 or 18 months, trying to regain the willingness to try to stay sober. I had a bottle of Speed in one pocket and a half pint of Jack Daniels in the other. That's something I
never would have dreamed of doing. And I did that for a year and a half. And by the grace of God, I had the ability to check back in. And one more time, God's grace shone on me, and I was able to get sober. I did the exact same thing again for 3 years. I joined a different fellowship. I hooked up with a motorcycle club. And I tried, you know, fellowship is great. And it works for a little bit of time. The problem is I'm a real alcoholic, and I've got a spiritual sickness. And I'm beyond human aid. But I had none of that information. None of that information. So after 3 years of the same thing, it happened again. And then God's grace kicks in. 2 weeks later. And I'm back at meetings being honest. I don't know anybody who gets chances like that. I was sober about a year and I had sold my business. I had a bunch of money in the bank. I was living with a wonderful girl. Some of you know her, some of you remember her. I was living right up on the side of the hill in Mendham. I had a Bronco, I had a Corvette, I had 3 Harleys, I had money in the bank, I had a beautiful girlfriend, I was living in the home of my dreams. I had everything, I had all the things aligned that I thought would fix that hole. And I'm running around the high school track in Mendham, because I'm a runner by nature. And one afternoon, I found myself on my knees crying out of nowhere. Hysterically crying like a little boy. And it occurred to me that I was still dying inside. And I had reached out for this big book thumper guy that I could not stand, you know, who I thought was preachy. But I know he knew the deal. His name is Howard G. May he rest in peace. He passed not too long ago. And he said to me, "Listen, Scott, I'm too busy, but there's this guy, Barefoot Bill. Some of you guys may know who he is. He's on fire right now. Here's his number. Give him a call." Barefoot Bill had been a guy that used to come to my motorcycle club's runs and wore a pinky toe. And that was not cool. I didn't think much of Barefoot Bill at the time. But I was willing to go to any lengths. I realized I was really dying. And what I will tell you is that that man, Barefoot Bill, literally, just about literally, he went home at night, moved into my house for the next 3 months, and took me through our basic text, word by word, line by line, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, page by page. And when he asked us to consider something, we considered it. When he asked us to take an action, we took an action. When he asked us to do a prayer, we did the prayer. And I will tell you that for the first time in my life, I understood what was wrong with me. You know, I understood that I was selfish and self-centered, and that that was the nature of my problems. You know, and we did a third-step prayer, and it blew me away. I felt it on the inside. You know, we did a seven-step prayer. And I started working the 12th step, and I got involved here in Burnsville, and I got involved in Baskin Ridge. And after some time passed, I got another sponsor, but he was still a big book guy. And I will tell you, it was pretty much the happiest time of my life, sobriety-wise. I had sold a business. I had gotten a job in corporate America for the first time. I had a place to come every night. I was a part of something at last. The promises were coming true for me. It says in the book, it says, create the fellowship that you crave. There was nothing more powerful for me than watching somebody, that aha moment, you know, in the third step, when they start to take on a new relationship with their creator the way I had, you know, the part where it says, he's the director, he's the principal, we're his agent, he's the father, we're his child. That stuff, it floored me. And when I saw the light go off in other people's eyes, man, that stuff was better than me, though, by every shot. It just blew me away. And things were going on like that pretty well for a while. What happened to me was I had to, in 2000, my father was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And He had surgery over at Sloan Kettering in New York, and my folks had moved to Florida to retire. And they were down there for 99. I guess I didn't realize it, but he had become terminal. So my father and I weren't just father and son. You know, aside from the usual thing that you put your parents through, you know, having them come to the emergency room and look down at you while you're dead, you know, kind of rips your heart out. And I had done all that too, but aside from that, we had worked together for a long time. And we really became best friends. And when he got sick, there was a kind of role reversal. And I kind of became his dad, and he kind of became my child. And I prayed him from doctor to doctor, and we got even closer. And about 4 years later, he was down in Florida, and, you know, my mom and sister, knowing how close I was with my father, didn't want to tell me that he was in hospice and that he was getting very close to death. And I kind of went down there and surprised him. To surprise him, I bought a new car, and I wanted to show them that it was a good excuse to drive down to Florida. And I found out my father was in hospice. And within 72 hours, I had transferred. My company was a national company. I transferred down to Florida, came back, grabbed the dogs, grabbed the bike, grabbed the car, and left, and moved down to Florida. And one of the miracles that this program has given me is that I was able to spend the last 3 months absolutely stone cold sober without the thought of a drink, practically lying in bed with my dad, and it was just an amazing experience. I ended up staying in Florida to take care of my mother and my sister, who's also an invalid now. And what I didn't do is I didn't take time to grieve my father's loss. Now, when I got down there, my sponsor told me, you know, you're on fire, keep rocking and rolling. And I did. I live right near a place called Boca House down there. And I had the opportunity to bring a meeting in every Saturday morning. And I got a couple guys through the work in that group. And we started a couple other big book meetings. I had a problem finding a big book sponsor. I basically started sponsoring myself, which is not a good idea. And I will tell you, I can look back at it now, and I can see the progression. I can see when I think of this, I think of two different people. When I think of myself, I think of two different, there's like two separate entities in each of us, or at least in me. I think of, you know, on the one side, there's that pure spirit, that child of God, and then there's that alcoholic ego that needs to remain in check. And, you know, mine was in check for a very long time. Once I got down to Florida, I could actually, and it's very subtle, but in hindsight, I could see where it started to rebuild. I was getting back to that place where I said, you know, if one more fucking newcomer whines, I'm going to bitch slap him. That's that sick, sick, unchecked alcoholic ego that's in my head. You know, my sponsor also says, you know, you've got to be working at all three sides of this fellowship, you know, meeting steps and service. I cut way back on my meetings. I couldn't deal with newcomers anymore. No service. Step work, forget about it. I think I did some prayer on some mornings, very little meditation. Again, I believe that relapse happens way, way before we pick up that first whatever. Way before. I had gotten some news in 05, I think it was, that I had five arthritic vertebrae in my neck. It was getting really bad. It's from riding motorcycles my whole life. And the doctors gave me two choices. They wanted to fuse the vertebrae or Percocets. What was my choice to be? I had slipped back into that world where I became an untreated alcoholic. I was not spiritually fit. What I am is basically a very undisciplined person. And I've come to realize that the spiritual growth in our program of recovery and in our fellowship comes from discipline. It comes from daily discipline. It comes from morning prayer and meditation. It comes from taking a look at ourselves in the evening. It comes from working with others on a daily basis. All right? It comes from staying current on your amends. I had an amazing opportunity just last week. I had a girlfriend from the time I was somewhere between 10 and 15, We were very, very close, and we hadn't seen each other in about 15 years after that. We hooked up in our 30s. And when I broke up with her, I said something you don't say to women. It wasn't something nasty. I wasn't trying to be mean. It was something along the lines of, you know, she could lose a few pounds, which is something you just don't say to women. And it was horrible. I actually did that to my ex-wife, too. And she came out, believe me, but that's another story. So what happens was I felt like I owed this amends for years and years and years. And I'm coming back to New Jersey, and a friend of mine calls me out of nowhere and says, hey, we're having a reunion. I used to spend my summers up in the mountains. And this girl I hadn't seen since I was 30, 31. It's one of my unfinished amends. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. I'm living in Florida. I'm back 3 weeks. This party's hooked up. I show up at the party, and there she is. I get to make one of my last unmade amends. The point is, I feel like I'm on such a tight rope. I can't really function if I've got amends that are still needed to be made. I got to get rid of that stuff quick, fast, in a hurry. I don't know what it is. It feels so unsettling to me throughout my day. If I know I've said or done something wrong, I had to make an amends this weekend to somebody that I work with that I really didn't want to do. I just don't have a choice anymore. If I want to stay sober, it's not even to stay sober. If I want to have some kind of semblance of peace in my life, you know, I've got to stay current on amends. I lost my place here. What happened was I chose the Percocets, and I took them properly for about 2 weeks, and I was off and running. And by the grace of God, one more time, it occurred to me that I could go to an AA meeting. So I got detoxed, went back to an AA meeting. What I left out of the part is that instead of grieving for my father, I ended up getting married. Did I skip that? Oh, yeah. What happened was I can't deal with feelings. I'm not good at dealing with feelings. My father passed away. I started having panic attacks. I couldn't drive over a bridge. It was really, really bad. I met this woman, and she was the exact opposite of my sex ideal. The exact opposite. So I don't know if you guys have gotten up to that, you know. But when you get to your sex ideal and around the fourth step, you might want to take a serious look at it. Because I ended up marrying somebody who was just another bright, shiny object. And, I love her now. I thought I loved her then. But I was never in love with her. It was just another band-aid on a gunshot wound. Once I got back to meetings, you know, a few years ago, after that little Percocet adventure, and started doing the work again. You know, I got the courage, the insight, and the belief to not waste any more of her time and pull the trigger. And I got divorced last January. The marriage had been over for quite some time. And I guess what I'm trying to get to is that I'm a failure at life. I really am. In my untreated state, I'm a complete failure in life. I'm not much good for anything. But when I'm given this program, and I apply this program to my life, things get good real quick, and they stay good for a long time. They stay real good for a long time. I feel better than I've felt in many, many years. Just moving back from Florida, coming back up here, the miracles, they come real quick for me. When you're operating, or when I'm operating in that fourth dimension, it's amazing. And again, in hindsight, what I feel like is when we're going through the steps, really in the third step, after the third step prayer, you know, there's no amen. And then there is one after the seven-step prayer. Right? And what seems to me what's happened is I'm making, and again, this is my experience, It seems to me that I'm making a covenant with God to live a certain way, to do certain things on a daily basis. I'm not a big religious guy. You know, I was raised Orthodox Jewish, and I ran from that as quickly as I could. Along my spiritual journey, I was baptized as a Christian. You know, I've opened my mind and my heart up to a lot of different things. But I can tell you, you know, right now, you know, I'm, I guess, kind of a pantheist. You know, whatever makes sense for you. The closest thing I can come to that even smells slightly of religion is the Big Book. It's the thing that works in my life and has never failed me. But I have failed it. You know, I have relapsed a few times because I feel I've broken my covenant. I've made this agreement to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him in the third step. And again, it defines the relationship, okay? But I don't follow through. There are times when I haven't followed through, and I pay the price for it. You know, I don't do it perfectly every day. But the days that I don't do it are much worse than the days that I do. I like being back in this environment where there's some folks who have been through the work. I feel very comfortable up here. You guys don't know how lucky you have it. It's not like this all over the rest of the states. You know, I've done some traveling. I can tell you that people that are involved in the book in Florida, for example, when I got down there in 03, late in 03, there wasn't a whole lot of Big Book going on. There wasn't a whole lot of recovery going on. And I watched a lot of people die in the time I was down there. And I'm grateful to be a part of this, you know, sort of grassroots movement that's slowly but surely, I think, bringing the fellowship back to step work. I guess I'm just very, very grateful to be here. That's all I have for tonight. Thank you.